Good morning. We're going to call the Agriculture and Food Finance and Policy Division to order. We do have a quorum, and the clerk will note the roll. We do have minutes to adopt from February 26th, so Representative Brand.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move the minutes from February 26th.
All right, those are in your packets. If you have any questions, additions, changes. Okay, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. The motion prevails, the minutes are adopted. So today we do have a full agenda again, and I just want to note for people that the next couple of meetings today and maybe the next 2 weeks, we meet on Tuesdays and Thursdays, and typically we might go until our time is to go to 11:15. We are extending that perhaps by 15 or 30 minutes, and that's in preference to coming back in the evening or doing a Friday meeting. So I think we can try to get everything in the time that we're allotted, which is 90 minutes, but if it does go over, please be aware of that, so you might want to make a note of that in your own calendars for committee members. So I appreciate that. Today we're going to start with a walkthrough on the Department of Ag's policy bill. We will not be moving that bill at this point. It's just really to get it before us and for us to understand what is in the bill. We also then will have a presentation on climate change and how it is impacting our farmers. Then we will have our discussion on Forever Green. So we'll have that bill that will be coming. Nothing will be actually moved out of committee today, but we will be hearing a number of things. But today, as we start our day, as you know, that you can look in the audience, you perhaps will see some blue jackets. And those blue jackets are our FFA members. So we're very pleased that we have a number of FFA members in the audience and here today for FFA Day at the Capitol. And we certainly also will have perhaps some that will come to your offices and have appointments with you. So please welcome them, because they are the current and future leaders for our state. And we are very happy to have them with us today. So I'm going to invite down two FFA officers. So we have Laura Lee Eaton, who's a state reporter, and Keegan Zimmerman, the state vice president. So if you'll come down before us, we welcome you to the committee. And we will ask you just to state your name and provide us your information. So whoever wants to start, thank you and welcome to the committee.
I can see that. Laura Lee Eaton.
And my name is Keegan Zimmerman.
So first of all, we would like to congratulate you all and thank you all for being here today. Today is FFA Day at the Capitol, and as you can tell by our jackets, we are here and we are present, and we're so excited to be here. To start off, I would like to tell you a little bit about myself. I'm Laura Lee Eaton, and I'm from Pine Island, Minnesota, so 10 minutes north of Rochester, and I am a first-generation hobby farmer, and I am your 2017-2019 state reporter. And so I like to tell you all about how I got started in FFA and agriculture. And so when I was in kindergarten, I begged and begged my parents for chickens. And finally, they caved, and I got my own chickens. And that was my spark for FFA and for agriculture, is that it slowly turned into something that I wanted more, but I didn't know how. And so when I was a freshman, I finally took my first ag class, and I was so taken back by the opportunities and the instruction that I got in the classroom that I took it out into FFA, into our supervised agricultural experiences, or our SAEs, as we call them. And that was my kickoff for FFA, is that I have a passion for agriculture, but coming from a more urban area and not having that sort of industrial agriculture ability, FFA let me start off of who I was and pursue my passion of agriculture. And so now I'm able and I'm willing to be a first-generation agriculturalist. And I find that so important, is that you can choose to be in agriculture, and everyone has an importance in agriculture. And so with agriculture and education and FFA, that's how we are going to get stuff done, and that's how we're going to get our next generation of leaders. And so a little fun fact is that my mom grew up in Rochester, and we have 25 urban chapters in the state of Minnesota. So I think that's so important to point out, is that we're getting to more of those urban areas where students can have that agricultural education classroom instruction and also FFA as well.
Very good. Thank you.
Yeah, and again, my name is Keegan Zimmerman, serving as this year's state vice president. And for a little bit of the opposite end of the spectrum across from Morley, I grew up on a small farm in southwest Minnesota. My parents raise corn and soybeans, but I was never super involved on the family farm. Instead, I was kind of hands-off of agriculture until I got into FFA. When I was in ninth grade, my ag teacher pressured me into taking an ag class, as I feel like most do. And I was really felt like I was at home in that ag class. And so going from there, I wanted to know what else I could do. So I looked into some opportunities that were around my area, and I found out that the University of Minnesota has a research station right outside of Lamberton. And so I started working there for a researcher, and that's how I got my foot in the door with the research side of agriculture. And so that's taken me a couple places. It was the research side and then the service side of FFA that really got me more involved in wanting to be an officer and looking for those opportunities, what I can gain and what I can give to students. So going along my research path, now I study at the University of Minnesota. I'm studying political science and applied economics. And I do research there with a professor and a grad student, and I'm really looking at how we can evolve research and involve more students in research. And so now going back to the opportunities, we in FFA like to give students as many opportunities as they can and a wide range of them. So whether you're looking at going back and producing food for consumers or you're looking at going into research or public policy even, you have avenues in FFA that will give you those skills that it takes to succeed in those areas. We also recognize that maybe not all students want to go to a four-year institution. Maybe work is right for them or a two-year institution. And we value all of those FFA members and all of those experiences. And so we want to give students those skills and opportunities that will give them a leg up in the career field that they choose to go into. And so it's been really amazing for Laurelie and I to be able to come and experience everything that the Capitol has to offer, everything that FFA has to offer, and show the students that are here today everything that they can learn from being here and speaking with all of you. So we hope that as you talk to them throughout the day, you can really listen to what they have to say and maybe give them some advice on where they can go in their future careers. And with that, we open it up to any questions that any of you may have for us.
Thank you, Ms. Eaton and Mr. Zimmerman. Are there any questions or comments? Very nice present. Yes, Representative Hamilton.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I was saying somebody has to ask him a question, right? And Ms. Sarah Dornick, and they also met with me this morning, and Ms. Dornick said we have to ask him a very difficult, random question, okay, right? Just a random question to try to put him on the spot. But I won't do that. I just want to know, tell me a little more about your agriculture educator, instructor, and how they how did they impact your life?
All right, so Mr. Zimmerman, you want to begin?
Sure. So I had a little bit of an untraditional go with agriculture education. I've had five different ag teachers in my one teacher program in my school. So almost every year I had a different instructor, and at certain points in my program I was the one that was really trying to get students engaged and involved. So right now we're experiencing an ag teacher shortage. There are more schools that want to expand their programs or start programs than we have teachers to fill those positions. And so my ag teachers, the various ones that I have, really impacted me in showing me everything that I'm able to do and connecting me with the people that are in the areas that I want to go into, whether that's economics or policy or research. And so I really value everything that they were able to impart on me, but I also realize that we don't have enough agriculture instructors to be able to fill all those positions. And so it's really crucial, especially for us now, to be pushing students to go towards agriculture, and we need agriculture educators to be able to train those next leaders, as we know that we can't have FFA programs without ag educators. And so as we're looking at expanding FFA, reaching more students in maybe an urban setting, we need ag educators to be able to be in those schools to have FFA. And so we really value ag teachers, and we're hoping that we can get more and we can continue to give students the value that ag teachers have to offer.
Thank you. And Ms. Eaton, would you just move the microphone down a little bit?
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Hamilton, for talking about this. So going into FFA, coming from an outside perspective, my FFA teacher changed my life. My instructor made me who I am today. He taught me what it's like to believe in someone, what it's like to be bigger than yourself. Like, all of us here are bigger than being a part of a bigger picture. And I think that's so important to stress, like, our members here today, is that we are a part of a bigger picture. We are a family of agriculturalists. And so I think that's so important, is that he changed my life. Like, he gave me purpose, direction, like, where you wanted to go with it. And I think that's so important, is what we see today is we have those educators. And all of our teachers, like, they're going to be the gatekeepers to all the knowledge. And so once we have those amazing teachers in there, you know what? Like, agriculture is going to be okay. And so that is why I am studying agricultural education at South Dakota State University. So thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hamilton.
And Madam Chair, just a comment, and I've said this before, when the FFA students come before this committee, it does not matter whether they're male or female, urban or rural, black, brown, or white. They are the best and the brightest the state has to offer. So I want to thank everybody for being here.
You have absolutely said it perfectly. Thank you to both of you for the presentation this morning, for coming, and always being articulate and capable of sitting in front of a group of people and being able to present yourselves very well. So thank you.
Thank you, Chair Poppy, and all of the members of the committee for your time.
Absolutely. Good to see the blue jacket. So thank you for being here. All right, so next we are going to go to Petter Cheseth is with the Department of Ag, and he is going to walk us through the House File 1733, which is the department's ag policy bill. This will be, we do have information in the packet, which also has the Mr. Sullivan's research summary. And this will be the bill that we will be working off of eventually. There may be things added or subtracted as the committee desires as we move along. But today we're going to hear what the department has introduced. And welcome to the committee. Please just state your name and then begin the information.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Petter Cheseth. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. And I just want to note that it's always a little intimidating to follow FFA members.
Yes, it is.
They set the bar pretty high. But I'll endeavor to do my best. I'm here today to walk us through House File 1733, which is essentially the department's policy bill. A number of these provisions will be familiar to the committee. You've heard some testimony on a few of them already, but we'll just start with sections 1 through 4. This is the AFRIC language, the Agricultural Fertilizer Research Education Council language that I believe Representative Anderson has already presented on in this committee. Essentially, the language extends the council for 10 years to June 30th, 2030. Section 5 pertains to storage of nursery stock. In current statute, all bald and burlapped stock is required to be kept in moisture-holding material. For example, simple wood mulch, sawdust, soil, or sand. However, this change is needed because a large amount of bald and burlapped nursery stock is delivered and placed under irrigation to maintain viability. This is particularly true for large wholesale sales sites such as Bachmann's and Gerton's. Essentially, this just allows the Commissioner of Agriculture to deem these irrigation systems as viable alternative storage methods for the bald and burlapped nursery stock. Sections 6 through 7 should also be somewhat familiar to the committee. This pertains to industrial hemp. The initiative aligns the definition of industrial hemp with the latest farm bill and allows for the agency to use expedited rulemaking process in order to submit our final plan to the USDA to seek approval for the 2020 growing season.
Quick question.
Representative Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a real quick question on the expedited rulemaking. What's the need there? Why the expedited? Because I know that cuts out a lot of the important public commentary on that. Can you give us a little bit of an indication why it needs to be expedited rulemaking?
Mr. Chesa.
Madam Chair, Representative, my understanding of it is, first and foremost, this is to comply with the requirements laid out in 2015 as it pertained to the industrial hemp pilot program. The need for the expedited rulemaking, to my understanding, is to ensure that the U.S. we can get our rulemaking process approved by the USDA in time to for the processes to be in place for the 2020 growing season.
Thank you. You may continue.
Thank you. Section 8 pertains to custom feed chapter conformity. This initiative aligns the state's commercial feed law with federal law under the definition of the drug. This is essentially the curious case of a missing semicolon. There is the state statute does not have a semicolon, the federal one does. This has resulted in some disagreements and confusion when trying to interpret the statute. So the solution here is to reinsert the semicolon and provide everyone with clarity. Yes. Sections 9 through 10, this pertains to the custom exempt food handler license. This also should be familiar to the committee in a previous department overview on the meat and dairy division. We spoke about these custom exempt food meat processors that are processing meat that is not for sale. It is for individual use only. This would allow these small operators to obtain a license that better reflects the scope of their business. It does not add or change a license fee. It simply creates another category that better fits these processors. And we believe that this would affect 50 to 75 existing businesses.
Mr. Chesif, if there are portions of this that was in a bill last year, could you just point those out too? I don't know if
yes, and
some of these perhaps.
Madam Chair, I might call upon Dr. Nikki Nesser of the Department of Agriculture to give more clarity to that, as she was here last year and I was not.
And you can go ahead and continue with presentation,
okay.
But I think just if there's an opportunity to note that some of those things were included last year.
Absolutely, you know. Madam Chair. Next is sections 11 through 14. They pertain to the delegated food licensing and inspection. The Department of Agriculture is allowed to delegate these authorities to local boards of health for food handler licensing and inspection. This initiative modifies language to clarify that this delegated authority can be for retail food handlers, regardless of what type of retail operation is being licensed. This would also conform statute to retail food handler licensing and inspection practices. Section 15 is the egg retailer storage conformity. This section changes the egg statutes to expand the time that eggs can be held by retailers past the pack date. For example, grade A eggs are allowed to be held for 46 days past the pack date, which more appropriately reflects the length of time eggs can meet grade A standards. rather than holding them to the same standard as grade AA eggs. Importantly, this change creates consistency with other state requirements, and it is part of a broader effort, part of MDA, to update requirements for egg manufacturing and sales and to write plain language statutes. Next, we have sections 16 through 18. This pertains to the changes made in the dairy chapter 32. In section 16, the milk storage requirements are reinserted, which include a waiver for the 72-hour time limit for milk pickups. This is particularly critical for those dairies that might not be able to afford more frequent pickup times, or in the unfortunate case of the recent weather in southeastern Minnesota where folks had to dump milk because the trucks couldn't get in there. Section 17 updates requirements for labeling of milk products to include the option of using the addresses of the distributors. The statute itself is very critical for milk traceability, but this change just allows more flexibility for milk plants. Section 18 reinserts the labeling requirements for aged raw milk cheese to include the label requirement that states cheese must be unpasteurized milk, where the unpasteurized milk is aged for more than 60 days. Section 19 pertains to emergency powers and a change in the provision. It would remove disease from the emergency powers of the department so that we are able to address emergencies that are broader in scale and that do not pertain to simply a disease. An example of this would be our efforts around Palmer amaranth. Sections 20 through 30 that pertain to the advanced biofuel and renewable chemical production incentives. These changes are intended to better define what is eligible for a production incentive payment under this program, which was passed with the intent of encouraging commercial-scale production of advanced biofuels, renewable chemicals, and thermal energy production from biomass. Sections 20 and 21 define the terms biomass and renewable chemicals, and you'll see those terms carried throughout the next provisions. Essentially, in implementing this program, staff noticed the definition of renewable chemical was unclear and could unintentionally result in payments for chemicals containing only a small fraction produced from a renewable biomass. Sections 22 through 24 carry again the term, new term biomass into the appropriate areas of the statute. Section 24 also defines what type of forest management plan is required, which is specified in the Sustainable Forest Incentive Act. Section 25 clarifies that only the percentage attributable to renewable chemicals in a blended product is eligible to receive payment. Section 26 is more clarifying language, as well as including forest management plan language from the Sustainable Forest Incentive Act. Next, we have Section 31, which pertains to livestock expansion under the Rural Finance Authority. This provision would essentially just allow for livestock expansion loans to be used to purchase existing livestock farm. Currently, the loans are only available to make improvements to an existing livestock operation. Sections 32 through 33 pertain to the beginning farmer tax credit. And these changes essentially represent the staff administering the program's belief in, or ways to better reflect the intent of the legislation. Section 32 removes the restriction that does not allow for this tax credit to be used by family members or spouses. This is a policy choice on the part of the Department of Agriculture. We believe that those who want to stay in farm and rural communities should be incentivized to do so. It also removes the requirement of submitting a profit potential statement. Through implementation of the program, our staff found this to be an unnecessary step in the process. We would also like to add waiver language to the education requirement. This language is consistent with education requirements for the Rural Finance Authority loan programs. Section 33 clarifies the appeal process for the Boone Farmer Tax Credit and aligns it with appeal processes used at the department for the Rural Finance Authority loan programs. Sections 34 through 35 pertain to the RFA's disaster recovery loan program. These changes would allow the RFA disaster recovery loan program to be used for circumstances, say, a market disaster or an economic emergency, and wouldn't limit use of the program just for a natural disaster or state declared emergency. This would add financial options for farmers when certain situations arise, such as coolies canceling milk or trade agreements, or again, the collapse of 20-some barns in southeast or in southern Minnesota. Currently, the process would require a state-declared disaster and could take some time, and this change would just allow the commissioner and the RFA board to act more swiftly to help address these situations. Section 36, you've heard of this before as well. This is the RFA Methane Digester Loan Program change, simply allowing more than one methane digester loan to go to an individual. Section 37 and Section 38 essentially just change loan limit amounts. Section 37, that pertains to the livestock equipment loan program, and Section 38, I believe, Farm Opportunity Loan Program, and essentially just raises the limit amount from $40,000 to $100,000. In the livestock equipment loan, and $45,000 to $100,000 in the farm opportunity loan program, and the ways of these limits just reflect the rising costs and inflation. These limits were set in the late 90s, and so they're just a bit outdated. And that, Madam Chair and members, is House File 1733, and I'd be happy to answer any of the committee's questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chesseth. Would you say that this is a fairly technical bill, and is there controversy within these pages? Where would you find the controversy?
Madam Chair and members, it is very technical, and perhaps the most controversial portion of it is that semicolon. But I think all sides have worked together and come to an agreement on it.
Thank you, Mr. Chesseth. I think Representative Cleborn.
I have one really small question. So when we talk about semicolons, they are important, you know, and an article is important, A and or the. So on page 17, line 17.29, forgive me for asking the question, but as a mediator, words matter. The definition of reasonable is often subject to debate. So I would just ask that word be looked at. And ask you maybe how you would define reasonable.
Mr. Chessa.
Madam Chair, Representative Claiborne, I agree. Also, as an attorney, I understand the amount of time that can be spent on trying to define what reasonable is. I can get back to you with specifics when I talk to the reviser and our own legal counsel, but I believe the term reasonable here is akin to what it would be under kind of a common understanding of the legal term reasonable. Okay. That is, you know, what the average individual would deem reasonable.
Perfect. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Are there other questions? And again, I don't know if today you're prepared to say this was included in last year's bill or this wasn't. I know as I've heard you describing it, I know there were certain things that I recall were in last year's bill. So,
And Madam Chair and members, my understanding is that essentially everything from sections 6 to section 38 was included in last year's bill. I can double check that for you and get back to the committee, but I believe the primary new policy language are the first five sections or so.
Thank you. All right, any questions? We are just hearing the information about House File 1733. There's no action being taken, but is there anyone that currently in the audience that wanted to make any comments regarding this bill? All right, then I think we're good to go. Appreciate the opportunity to have the bill presented as you did, provide the information for us. So
thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Thank you. And we are going to switch over now to our presenters on how climate change impacts Minnesota farming. And as Dr. Pardee and Dr. Seeley come down before us, I'm going to, Representative Tabke, you want to just make a comment.
Thank you very much, Chair. I just want to take a second and welcome Kenzie Barth. She's a U of M plant sciences student. She's back here in the corner. Wait, Ken, she is College of Ag has a shadowing program, so she's hanging out with me this morning, and she has to leave before the end of Ag Committee. So I just wanted to say thank you to Kenzie for being with us here today and learning about what we do as reps. And she asked me if everything moves this fast all the time as we were going around and seeing things this morning. And the answer I've learned is yes, it absolutely does. So thank you, Kenzie, for being here and for the U of M for putting that program together. So thank you, Madam Chair.
And thank you, Representative Tabke. I appreciate, you know, we do have students that shadow us periodically, and it's always good to welcome them to the committee and appreciate any comments that they may share with us about the process and procedure here. So we welcome you to the committee today. We're glad that you are here to be able to provide us some information. You know, certainly we are have been through quite a bit of weather in the last couple of weeks, but I know that there's a difference sometimes as we're talking about weather and climate. So today we're going to talk about climate change and the impact on Minnesota farmers and farming. So we welcome you to the committee. We would just invite you to state your name and give us your testimony. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for the invitation today. My name is Mark Seeley. I am a retired University of Minnesota faculty member, Department of Soil, Water, and Climate on the St. Paul campus, retired after 40 years last year.
And my name is Phil Pardee. I am Director of Global Research Strategy for the College of Food, Agriculture, and Natural Resource Sciences on the St. Paul campus.
Welcome. So I think you have a presentation that's on the screens, and we have not in our packet. So we're going to watch, we're going to listen and watch the screens to see the presentation. So
okay,
you may begin.
Thank you very much. I am here today as not only maybe a Minnesota historian and a climate scientist, but also as a citizen. Before I give my content, I'd like to just make a couple of comments in that regard. at times the committee may hear passion in my voice because my roots in Minnesota are quite deep. My great-great-grandfather came here in 1854 and helped found this state, serving in the territorial legislature and the first Minnesota state legislature. My great-grandfather served in the Union Army for Minnesota in the Civil War, and my grandfather helped organize and found the farmers in Swift County, Minnesota, before he went bankrupt naturally due to the drought of 1910. So I speak with passion about this topic that we're going to talk about today, and I don't necessarily ask for forgiveness, but I want you to understand where I'm coming from. So I'll start off with the evidence for climate change in Minnesota is profound, it's prolific, it's highly amplified, and we should all use it to take action to cope with it. The first slide is simply showing you two renditions of the Minnesota Weather Almanac, which I published for Minnesota Historical Society. Spent 8 years of my professional life dedicated to Minnesota's climate history. In the roughly 10-year span between edition one and edition two of this book, a measure of the pace of change that Minnesota's climate is undergoing is depicted in that in roughly a 10-year interval, we set over 17,000 new daily climate records in the state of Minnesota within the Observer Network, and that's just solely in the attributes of temperature and precipitation. We also set 165 all-time state records, measurements of temperature and precipitation that have no evidence of history on the Minnesota landscape. And that is striking evidence about how fast our climate is changing. There's too many ways it's changing to present to the committee today, but I wanted to concentrate on the attributes of temperature, water vapor, and precipitation. All of those have profoundly changed in our lifetimes here. We should know and understand, for example, on this graphic from the contiguous 48 states, just in the temperature attribute alone, in the last 100 years, we occupy a piece of American real estate that has seen some of the most positive change in temperature anywhere in the U.S. And we have documented this well in our work with the Minnesota State Climate Office and with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. These changes are meaningful. These in a scientific test, if you will, or a test of rigor of their scientific evidence, pass all kinds of statistical significance tests. So what we're seeing is not any kind of a random behavior, but it's a net change in the temperature attribute of our climate. Dovetailing with that and affecting Minnesota's agriculture is more frequency of episodic high dew point air masses coming into the state. We have no record of measuring a water vapor content in the state of Minnesota anywhere of 80 degree dew point until the year 1983. For your personal analogy of what an 80 degree dew point is, that's what you feel when you step off the airplane at Cancun, Mexico, when you go there for a vacation. It is a high dose of water vapor that is but much more typical of a tropical or subtropical environment than a mid-continent environment like Minnesota. Combined with the increase in temperature and the more high frequency of large dew points in the state of Minnesota is a higher frequency of heat advisories and heat warnings from our National Weather Service. In the book, I document all the significant heat waves we've had in the state history. Most of the ones that are colored in brown and red are due to the combination of high temperature but with high dew point conditions. We had human mortality on the Minnesota landscape in 1917 and 1936. Beyond that, we have not seen a lot of human mortality. We've seen a lot of human suffering from these heat waves, but not a lot of mortality like we did in 1917 and 1936. I would also point out that in the brown highlighted years there, we've seen significant livestock loss in the state. In our poultry industry, our hog industry, and our beef and dairy industries, we've seen impacts from those heat waves induced by higher temperature and higher water vapor content in our state. This is a measure of an all-time heat wave afflicting the state over July 19 and 20 of 2011. The numbers shown associated with the climate stations in the table there represent all-time high heat index values for those communities. I would also share with you that the 134 degrees measured at Moorhead, Minnesota in the Red River Valley at that time ties Furnace Creek, Death Valley for the highest heat index ever measured in our country. No one would have ever thought before this occurred that any place on the Minnesota landscape would ever tie Furnace Creek, Death Valley for any temperature measurement. The attribute of precipitation, too, in our own backyard is highly prolifically going upward. We've had some of our wettest years in history. Ranked 2016 and 2010 are in that category, so recent memory. Last year alone, we had areas of southeastern Minnesota surpass 60 inches of annual precipitation for the first time in our history. We now, on average, have about 3 inches more per year in Minnesota delivered in annual precipitation than we formerly had. Embedded in that upward signal in precipitation is, in fact, a character change in our precipitation, where the high-dose events, the 2-, 4-, 6-inch rains, are increasing in frequency and wreaking a lot of damage to our natural landscape as well as our infrastructure. In the first 140 years of our state history, which dates back to deployment of the Smithsonian Observation Network in the 1850s, we only recorded 7 what we call mega rain events, where we had a 6-inch rainfall over 1,000 square miles of Minnesota territory. However, since 2002, we've had 7 more. They've showed no preference for geography, as these intense mega rainstorms have occurred in almost all parts of the state geographically. They're all quite memorable for the residents of those sections of the state, and I might further add that in all cases, FEMA had to declare a flood disaster in the state with all of these events. Then we had this peculiar measure of climate behavior in the year 2012, which is perhaps a signal of what we might face in the future given our trends, and that is at the same moment in time we had 57 Minnesota counties declared by USDA for federal drought disaster, all of those color-coded here on the Minnesota map. The residents in those states were eligible for federal assistance for drought. And simultaneously, in the counties with the plus sign embedded in them, they were declared by FEMA for flood disasters. And residents of those counties could simultaneously seek drought assistance or flood assistance. This had never happened before in state climate history until the year 2012. Consequences are evident, and in addition to the evidence of measured climate change in Minnesota, we see prolific evidence of consequences. Those that affect agriculture include higher soil temperature duration in the autumn season that dictates when we can put fall nitrogen on, change in overwinter survival rates of some of our agricultural pests, longer frost-free growing seasons, increased freeze-thaw cycles, and erratic changes in load limits on some of our rural roads, changes in seasonal migration of insect pests to Minnesota agriculture, changes in the biological dynamics of our growing seasons, whereby we have more generations of one troublesome insect occurring in one growing season than we used to have. Longer exposure times for molds and allergens for those who are susceptible to these kinds of elements of our environment. And as I said, more frequent heat advisories and stressors on our livestock industry in the state. From a hydrologic perspective, we have had to give more attention to irrigation, drainage, runoff, sediment, and shoreline management to preserve our water resources. A change in storm sewer runoff designs are prolific throughout the state to accommodate these tremendous amounts of runoff from these storms. Mitigation of soil erosion, strategies for gaining better control of flooding on all scales of watersheds in the state, and huge changes in the insurance industry in terms of both products offered as well as the rates we are charged for insurance. These are all manifestations of the measured changes of climate in our state. The frightening thing for me as a Minnesota citizen is that the pace of change in the Minnesota climate is so much faster than anything we've observed in the instrumental record and arguably anything we've observed in the paleo record for this piece of real estate, that we need to see the sense of urgency in moving forward with our knowledge, our technology, and our innovation to address these in an accelerated way. And that, above anything else, is the bottom line message that I would like you to digest today. The evidence is overwhelming and should serve as an impetus for us to act, but the urgency of acting is piling up year by year by year. And I hope you will think about that seriously for your constituents that you represent around the state of Minnesota. At this point, Madam Chair, we would like to convert, or if you will, go to the innovative side and the applied economic side, and Dr. Pardee will address that.
Thank you, Dr. Seeley. And Dr. Pardee, will welcome to the committee. And make that transition.
Just while the slides are being flipped over, you'll soon notice that this is not a Norwegian bachelor farmer accent. I hail from down under, but I had the good sense to marry a farm girl from southern Minnesota who's been had a family farm in Dodge County since 1856, so we're very close to when Mark's family came over. So Is it ready? No, it's not ready. So.
They're still working on it. Well, we welcome you to Minnesota.
Hang on, I think I've got it here.
Glad you're here.
Thank you. So as Mark said, I'm going to, Mark made the case for the nature of climate change generally and specifically with respect to Minnesota, and I think emphasized the fact that we're sitting in a part of the planet that's being exposed to the most rapid rate of change in climate, as our records show. I'm going to focus my remarks on, so what can we do to ameliorate the effects of agriculture on climate and to mitigate the effects of climate on agriculture, and focus on the role of investing in innovation to deal with these issues. Preface my remarks by, I think this committee doesn't need to be reminded that agriculture's of critical economic importance to the states. I grabbed the latest USDA cash receipts data, which shows that we ranked eighth in the nation and produced $7.6 billion worth of output with respect to animal products last year. We're fourth with respect to crop production. And so overall, to this economy, agriculture contributes $17 billion worth of cash receipts. So we're having to juggle this impact of the changing ecological nature on production agriculture. And the reason it's particularly important with agriculture is very different than many other production processes, that it's at root a biological production process. It has animals and crops that are subject to some factors that we control and farmers control, but many we don't, and the sorts of inputs that go into agriculture are things like land and labour and seed, machinery and energy, But weather is a major input into agriculture. Since we have to deal with the impacts of weather on agriculture, farmers have to confront two major issues when they're making the decisions about the input mix that they make. This is sort of the last mile problem that farmers have to deal with in the nexus between weather and climate and agriculture, and that is the timing of their operations, that is what crops to plant when and how to grow those crops, and importantly, what crops to grow where on the landscape. And I think Mark's remarks show that at a given point on the Minnesota landscape, we're getting much more variation in the climate that farmers are having to confront, and climate's just a long-run manifestation of weather, which farmers are having to confront day to day. And over time, the location of agriculture is shifting, and so we have to deal with these very site-specific effects of weather with respect to agriculture. We've actually done some work to show that the latitudes within which Minnesota sit are not only important, obviously, for Minnesota, but they're important for global agriculture. So it turns out that the latitude band that I've shown there on this map, that latitude band alone grows over half of the entire world's crop production, and Minnesota sits at a key point in that locus. We have a series of research and outreach centres that are strategically dotted throughout the state, which are reflecting the large agroecology that we're a very long latitudinal state, so we've got a large differentiation in climate between the southern counties and the northern counties. And because this issue of weather is always a local problem with agriculture, we have to address those local problems to be able to give farmers the tools and instruments that they can use to combat climate change in agriculture. So Minnesota has a very unique role not only to play with respect to serving its own farmers, but it has a really unique physical position with respect to global agriculture. We have a fantastic map division at the University of Minnesota Libraries, and we've been working with the folks in that libraries to get a digital map of what Minnesota looked like in the middle of the 1800s, that is just pre-settlement. And you can see in the colouring here that the lighter colours on the map to the prairies, the yellows are the brushland, and the dark and light green are the forested areas, and the bluer areas are the water areas. And so before we actually started more intensively farming the Minnesota landscape, that's what our landscape looked like. By 1910, we'd pretty well cleared lots of the prairies and had moved in and started to clear some of the hardwood and other forest areas. And so a major expansion of the agricultural footprint on the landscape occurred during the latter part of the 19th century. We continued to expand the footprint of agriculture through to the middle of the last century. And this is a sense of what the landscape looks like today. So we can see a substantial, roughly half of the land mass in the state is in cropping and pasture production. So that's what actually happened. What I'm going to show you on the next slide is to show you what would have happened if we hadn't had the productivity growth in agriculture since over the last 60 years to allow us to restrain the footprint of agriculture, but at the same time produce a lot of economic value for agriculture. So the slide, the image on the right is our best measured view from satellite imagery of what the land use looks like in 2007. The cycling image on the left of the screen is showing that as we start, as we turned off the productivity spigot or the R&D spigot in 1949, to produce the amount of output that we were producing over that period, we would have had no option but to continue ploughing in a much larger and larger share of the state. And in fact, it's incredibly dramatic in the economics, which I am, we call it the counterfactual. So what would have the world looked have liked in the absence of investments in innovation and R&D? And it turns out it's a remarkable achievement of Minnesota agriculture that during this period, we in real terms increased agricultural output threefold. Just to think about that, that's a massive amount of increase in agricultural production, a threefold increase in production. If you look at the bar charts on the left set of bar charts, is the amount of land that we used in agriculture in 1949 in blue, in orange in 1978, and in 2007. So we achieved a threefold increase in agricultural output while actually reducing the footprint of land in agriculture. If we turned off the productivity spigot, the bar charts on the right show that to produce that threefold increase in output, we'd have had to continue ploughing in, clearing forests, perhaps draining more marginal wetlands and so forth. And in fact, our estimates are by 1977 to produce that output, we would have moved into Canada and started ploughing in some of the Canadian prairies. And so the impact of innovation on agriculture is huge in the sense that it actually has allowed us to fundamentally reduce the footprint of agriculture and address lots of environmental problems, but at the same time, specifically address the problems with respect to climate change. As you know, we're a large corn-producing state. We've done some data on not only does the footprint of agriculture move over the landscape, the footprint of individual crops move as well. So here's a snapshot of where in the US corn production took place in 1949, and here's a snapshot of where in the US and in Minnesota crop production took place in 2007. And you can just see visually that there's been a huge shift in that landscape. In fact, our calculations are that over the last century, the average corn plant has moved over 150 kilometres in a northwesterly direction. And as we shift the location of production, we're changing that climate to crop relationship because that relationship is all a local phenomena. And so the good news story is that we've actually been able to, through innovations in agriculture, the introduction of shorter duration corn varieties. We used to have corn varieties that took 130 days to mature. They now take 80 days to mature. So that's why we've been able to get corn up into Minnesota, where we have a shorter growing season. That also gives farmers lots more flexibility as to when they actually plant that crop. And so that's a clear case of innovation, in this case in corn, giving farmers the wherewithal to actually address local and variable climate conditions. We overlaid this movement of corn with respect to spatialised climate data, and it turns out that over this period of time, on average, as reinforcing Mark's map that he put up earlier, the average temperature across the total US area over the last 60 years has increased about 1.9 degrees centigrade. But because we've moved corn from these southerly states up into the north in the Midwest and so forth, we've actually reduced the climatology that's hit the US crop and reduced it by over a degree. But in Minnesota, referring to Mark's comments, we've been increasing the temperature footprint on corn in Minnesota. Now, corn in Minnesota has grown in a lower than average temperature regime that is in the rest of the country, so there's a bit of movement to go. But the sorts of changes that Mark's alluding to really raise questions like Mark raised in my own mind about our capacity to address these climate shifts in the future. I focus my remarks mainly on cropping agriculture. Just one slide here to show you the remarkable consequences of the effects of innovation in not only growing value in milk markets in the US, but also reducing the environmental footprint of agriculture. So it turns out since the middle of the last century, we've had more than a fourfold increase in total milk production per cow. Just to think about that for a minute, that's a hell of a lot of milk per cow over that period of time. And what that does is means we've been able to reduce, relative to 1944, again the counterfactual, we've reduced the number of animals in milk production down to about a fifth of what they were. We've reduced the feed down to about a quarter of what it would have been without that growth in productivity. We've reduced the land footprint, we've reduced the carbon footprint and so forth. So there's a direct relationship between our ability to affect sort of environmental outcomes in agriculture and productivity growth, and a key part of that is giving farmers the capacity to deal with these variable and localised climate changes. So I think Mark alluded to the big changes we've seen historically in climate change, and I'm sort of laying a groundwork to look forward. So what are we going to do about it as these changes continue in the future? And clearly passing out whether the structural trends versus the cyclical versus the transitory changes in climate looking forward is a tough thing to do, and there's lots of modelling efforts around to do that. But there's definitely a scientific consensus that there is a structural shift going on in the climatology. There's still some uncertainties about what the magnitude and the timing of these temperature and rainfall and other changes are going forward, and the degree to which the broader state and national evidence translates down to a local evidence, that is in a farmer's field. So that's certainly tough stuff to measure, but nonetheless, so there's uncertainty around that, but I think there's no uncertainty to the fact that we've got this climate change processes affecting Minnesota agriculture going forward. We invented farming 10,000 years ago, and the day one when we invented farming, farmers have had to deal with weather fluctuations in weather and its impact on their operations. And I'd like to point out, even though, you know, good people might disagree about the magnitude or the timing of these changes in climatology that's going forward, the sorts of innovations that address those climate events are exactly the same sorts of innovations that affect weather and allow farmers to deal with weather and agriculture. So it's not a matter of taking resources away from doing something that drives value for Minnesota farmers and putting it into something else. It reinforces the value proposition for Minnesota agriculture. And I, as an ag economist, I sort of like to look at investing in ag innovations to deal with climate risk as somewhat analogous to investing in crop insurance. That is, it's a very practical way that you can proceed to prepare for the possibility of an adverse event. But there's a big fundamental difference between crop insurance and investing in innovation, and that is crop insurance just incurs a cost. It's a cost on the part of the insured, that is, you're paying the insurance company, and it's a cost on part of the insurance company because if there's an adverse climate event, you pay out. You do nothing to affect the actual shape and nature of the risk outcomes as a consequence of climate change. Investing in R&D and innovation actually gives farmers the capacity to mitigate or manage those climate risks. It actually lowers the overall risk exposure to farmers in agriculture. And some work I did with some colleagues several years ago shows that actually it's not just a cost, it's an investment that yields an economic return to the state. So to Minnesota, our estimates are over the last century that the rate of a return on a dollar invested in Minnesota ag R&D is a staggering 24%. And so that means roughly for every dollar we put into ag R&D, we get $40 back. And we get $40 back in terms of lowering the costs of farming, that evidence I showed you, increasing the productivity of farming, lowering the risk exposures on agriculture and so forth. And so investing in innovation agriculture is a very practical way of dealing with the realities that Mark made very clear in his remarks. So I think just my final comment here that absent these investments in agricultural innovation, I think my view is we'll simply be adding to the riskiness of farming. We add to the riskiness of the downstream supply chains, food processing sectors and so forth, which have played a big role in the Minnesota economy and the jobs that depend on agriculture in future decades. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Pardee. Are there any questions? Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to both the testifiers for your presentation. You know, when we talk about climate change from a political perspective, right, I try to sum it up this way, from a political perspective. First, I'm going to start with something that everybody can agree on, and I want to end with something that everybody can agree on. My first statement, when I'm asked about this, I say climate changes, it always has and it always will. I think everybody can agree on that. Then the next question is always, Representative, do you believe in man-made or the fact of humankind impacting climate change? And once that question is raised, typically what I've experienced is lines start being drawn, walls go up, tempers start to flare, and debate is stifled. From a political perspective, is something that I've witnessed. And so my response then is, you know what, just for a moment, and let's say that that question is irrelevant. And they said, what do you mean by that? And I said, well, first of all, the climate is changing. We can see that as you placed in the examples within agriculture. We see that all over, that climate is changing. And so I simply want to say we must strive to do better at what we do every single day. And again, so I think that is something that we can agree on as well. I frankly believe that the climate is changing. I frankly believe that, and through your help and others, we see that. Like I said, we see that impact in agriculture. But again, around here, a lot of times we get lost in the debate around whether or not it's man-made. So then I come back and say something that we can agree on, once again, is that we must strive to do better at everything that we do. I don't know, comments from either of you?
And Dr.
Thank you for those remarks, Representative Hamilton. I agree with you. The amendment to your statement that I would add from my experience in all 87 counties and working for Extension for 40 years is that we have people who are provoked to act now and in a more accelerated way, because the change is fast-paced. We can't use lessons of history like we know former legislators, former farmers, former local units of government have had to cope with a lot of variation, a lot of extremes, a lot of traumatic events. But the pace of change that's going on for our generation is unprecedented. And so our response needs to be somewhat unprecedented. And it's gratifying to see around our state so many wonderful examples of communities and organizations finding ways to respond. We have had in play, and I think some of you in the room know this, since 2007, the statewide Minnesota Climate Adaptation Partnership, which hosts annual meetings across all sectors of the Minnesota economy, not just agriculture, where we bring together practitioners who've actually deployed some strategies to adapt in the local setting and are telling a lot of wonderful success stories. I mean, we also get stories of failure, but that's the intent of having a practitioners conference. It's not an academic conference. It's a conference to bring citizens together to share their experiential knowledge about what works and what doesn't. And it's very gratifying for me, at my stage of life at least, to see Minnesota citizens acting in this way. I just wish that we could push the pace of adaptation to a quicker pace. And that's kind of the intent of my message as a citizen today, because I see the overwhelming evidence and I don't see it slowing down, or I don't see it suddenly stopping. So I'm really glad to hear we're all on the same page, it sounds like, in recognizing what's happening to us, in deploying a course of action. As Dr. Pardee has pointed out, we've got ample evidence of how successful we've been in the past with innovation, and we need to keep pushing that forward into the future.
Thank you, Dr. Seeley. We have another question, and we'll need to, I know Dr. Boer has to get on the road fairly soon, so we want to make sure we move into the next bill as well. And just want people to know that we will post all of the information that you presented on our website, so people will be able to review it and go back to it. And Representative Brand, a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, speakers, today for presenting. This was great information for us to see. I think it should be required information for anybody that's in an agricultural environment, anybody that's looking to going to a future college degree, because you are right. We do need to accelerate how we attack this problem, and it is a problem. On the campaign trail, I have been asked several times, do I believe in climate change? And my response is simply, I don't need to believe in it. I understand it. There's the difference. The difference is in how we ask the questions. The conversations need to change. We don't need to ask if we believe in it or not. We need to ask how, if the people who are running for office, who are running to make change in the world we live in, understand it or choose not to understand it. That's the difference. And the last thing I'll end on is in the early and mid-1900s, when we had cabins next to lakes, we used to flush our toilets and went right into the lake, straight piped our sewage right into the lakes that we swam in and we fished in. But now we know better, and now we don't do that. But we still continue to straight pipe our carbon emissions into the atmosphere, and we need to know better. We need to do better. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Representative Brand. And thank you again, Dr. Seeley, Dr. Pardee, for this presentation. Very much appreciate helping to educate us, enlighten us about the impact of climate on farming. So thank you for your time today. And we will move now. We're going to have House File 962. So Representative Brand, this is kind of leading into another part of this topic, so Forever Green. There is the information is in your packets. This is a bill that my intention would be to lay over today. So, Representative Brand, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, I would like to move House File 962, please.
For possible inclusion in the Omnibus Ag Finance Bill. That's what the motion will be. All right. So, and I know you have presenters and testifiers, so I'll let you get started. And I do know in earlier speaking with Dr. Boer that he would like to be able to get on the road fairly soon. So if you can begin your presentation.
Yes, absolutely. So thank you. Members, you'll find today that you've got a whole bunch of information about Forever Green, a bunch of handouts. You're going to hear from a bunch of experts. You're going to hear from testifiers who are educators in the that are doing research at the University of Minnesota. The Forever Green Initiative is an idea around the agricultural legacy that we have in Minnesota. For a long time, we've been working off of a very limited amount of agricultural products in Minnesota, but there's this particular initiative would provide a revolution in the amount of agricultural products and the diversity that would be available for production, development, and usage across our state. Untapped and unmet possibilities for an economy in Minnesota to continue to thrive and continue to do well, perhaps not be ranked number 7th in the economy in the United States, but perhaps 4th, 3rd. We've got the land, we've got the ability, we've got the capabilities, we've got the human capital necessary to do this sort of thing. And so I endeavor today to talk about research funding in order to keep the Forever Green Initiative going, and I look forward to having a good conversation about ways that we can support this into the future.
Thank you, Representative Brand. And we are going to intend to be concluded by 11:30, so we're going to go a little bit over today, but be aware that so about 33 minutes. Dr. Boer, I believe you're first up on the agenda, so we'll welcome you and have you begin. And I know your presentation information may be a little bit longer, and that's okay. And for others, we're going to try and really hold you to like 2 minutes to be able to provide the right amount of testimony as well as any questions that our committee may have. So welcome to the committee, Dr. Boer.
Hey, thank you, Chair Poppy, and I could ask for dispensation from the State Patrol maybe on my way down to Austin or something. As Chair Poppy said, I'm Brian Boer. I'm Dean of the College of Food, Agricultural, and Natural Resource Sciences at the University of Minnesota, and I don't think we could have set this up in better timing with the presentations earlier that we heard today. And I'll start off with a quote that I found in a very old publication from Horace Greeley in 1860. He was the person who said, go west. And he said, I will not live in Minnesota because you cannot grow apples there. For 150 years, the University of Minnesota has set out to prove Horace Greeley wrong by developing and adapting new crop varieties with examples including Minnesota 13, which was the first open-pollinated corn variety developed in the late 1800s. We brought soybeans to Minnesota as a forage crop originally to be fed to livestock, and, of course, now it's the second leading crop produced in Minnesota. And through development, that, as well as Dr. Pardee said, is moving northward, which we didn't think we could do with photosynthetic characteristics of soybeans. And, of course, as you know, we now have several apple varieties like Honeycrisp and First Kiss and Zestar and so on. So we have successfully done that for quite a while. And today the university hears that challenge again. From farmers, consumers, agribusinesses, environmentalists, and, of course, the presentation you just heard, to produce some new crops with economic value for Minnesota and productivity for Minnesota and food value and a new outcome, ecosystem service values. And we're setting out with Forever Green to do exactly that, reach exactly those goals, and try to develop those products. It becomes one portfolio. As Dr. Pardee said, in the productivity gains we've had, a new portfolio of crops to bring into that have potential to develop and deliver on those ecosystem service values, cleaner water, more healthy soils, and water quality issues. A couple of crops are key examples right now. In fact, today I think you had earlier, there's some leftovers here if you'd like some more, it looks like. Some muffins and baked goods that are using intermediate wheatgrass or kernza. If you go back to the 10,000 years, Dr. Pardee said at one time when humans started to adapt to agriculture, we developed wheat from wild varieties of grains. Intermediate wheatgrass is essentially that same kind of an idea, taking a wild crop or what hasn't been developed and developing that crop into a perennial grain, which is quite interesting because it reduces tillage, of course, from that perspective. It has very deep roots, adding organic matter to soils to improve the health of soils and improves the sequestration of carbon in soils. So this straight piping of carbon comment, that idea of bringing those into that use. It can also be used for livestock feed as well as for, of course, food grade uses as you have in front of you. Another sort of category, camelina and pennycress are a couple of oil crops that are being developed. These are annual crops, annual winter crops. And I think an innovative side, as we've talked about perennial side of this, of course, that's substituting one crop for another. With these annual crops, what we see happening is they're actually integrating into our current production systems. So a corn grower, a soybean grower, for example, might be able to early seed. These are winter annuals. Think about your winter wheat crops, for example, early emergence in the spring. You could perhaps harvest those crops, then come behind that with the soybean rotation. They're not quite ready for prime time, but there's rapid innovation there because of techniques we have in molecular genetics, gene editing. So our ability to develop and rapidly move those crops to fruition are far beyond. Think about the 10,000 years ago and how long it took us to get to dwarf wheat varieties for Norman Borlaug. We're talking about a matter of a decade or less to do that now. So dramatic changes in innovation, the abilities to adapt those crops. Forever Green really uses the scope of multidisciplinary research at the University of Minnesota. It really demonstrates our ability to work across those areas. So I'm going to work through this list across just CFANs. We're working with the College of Science and Engineering, College of Biological Science involved, but it involves soil, water, climate sciences, looking at how does it affect water quality, how does it affect soil health, how does it affect carbon sequestration. I've already mentioned it works across, of course, agronomy and crop genetics, the agronomic side. We recognize farmers have these decisions to make, as Dr. Pardee was saying. How do we incorporate these crops into cropping systems that farmers can do that readily, attain profitability, and achieve the other goals we've talked about? So agronomic science has become a part of it. Another example of this with gene editing has been very interesting. In one of the crops, and soybeans actually, you can't go out and eat raw soybeans because of compounds that are not digestible by humans. These are also an aspect of other crops. We've been able, within a couple of years, eliminate, I believe it's camelina or pennycress, I can't recall which one, eliminate that characteristic from that crop so it's ready for food-grade use as an oil, similar to canola in Canada now. So very rapid changes in the development and feasibility of crops coming forward. We're using agroinformatics and computational sciences. Dr. Pardee was talking about where are crops grown. Look at where should these crops be grown on the landscape in very precise ways for farmers. Also improves our genetic components so that we're putting them in places where we get the maximum environmental consequences and the productivity. So where they're placed on the landscape matters for how they interact, not only for productivity and the food products they're creating, but also how they're impacting, for example, water quality. Placing on areas where you get maximum, you get some runoff and try to reduce that runoff in the cover crop. You can really start to do that. There's a wellhead protection scenario with this being developed that's a part of that idea. And to be able to place that on the landscape with precision agriculture is quite remarkable. Of course, we don't eat raw grains. As we're developing new oil seeds and new grains, we have to find out how we process them, mill them, create new food products. So food science nutrition is a key part of bringing those crops into the production system as food products. We're working with biochemists and chemical scientists thinking about how do we bring these into biofuel use, how do we bring them into jet fuel, for example, is one use for those. Polymers for plastics, I think you hear from a testifier later on about the polymer characteristics. We're all concerned about plastics on the landscape now. These biodegradable plastics and polymers that may come out of these crops are really quite innovative as well. And then economics. The novel part about this, I think, from history and now going forward, is that we're going to these are being moved in economically viable ways so that they're creating profit for the farmer, they're creating food value for the consumer, they're delivering ecosystem service values that reduce our needs to mitigate some of those. So looking at that full economic picture. So we're bringing economists into the story, which is always, of course, a good thing. And we're always hard to get in. The last piece, I'll talk a little bit about the funding. And core long-term based funding from the legislature is critical. because new crop development is a long-term process. As much as we've shortened it up, I was talking to one of our crop geneticists recently about some new genetics in corn. Asked him when he started developing those. He said it was 2002. And they're just getting to the point where they're starting to replicate it. And this was a person working at the frontiers of molecular genetics and development. That's not even into the field yet. So there still is time as we're developing these crops that we don't go into the so-called valley of death. That period of making the investments, trying to get the crop out there, getting into a viable place so it can be sold and commercialized by folks like General Mills or PepsiCo, there's that period where that development has to occur, but it does take time. And the public sector investment, as Dr. Pardee talked about it, is essentially a form of insurance. You know, most companies aren't going to wait around through their quarterly or annual reports to develop these 12- and 15-year pieces without an ROI. The public sector, historically, the role of the legislature and the public sector in ag R&D has to provide that capitalization to move products like this forward. They might be risky. Some won't succeed. Some will succeed. That's a role for the entire society to de-risk that innovation and try to move it forward. So this core funding is really critical to accomplishing that goal. The funding, as we'll use it, will support faculty, researchers, technicians, postdocs, facilities, the usual things that we do at the University of Minnesota. I think a really key part of Forever Green, it's inspired a lot of our young people who are recognizing, as Dr. Seeley said, he's at a stage in his career. We're not sure he's going to experience all the climate change that's here. Sorry, Dr. Seeley. But for young people coming into these fields, they're looking for how are we going to address and deal with these grand challenges. We're seeing our grad students come in. These FFA students are looking for ways to impact and change the world. We heard that from students this morning. These projects are attracting that next generation of students, and they're really thinking about how can they make a change in this, and Forever Green is starting to attract that. That creates talent development for Minnesota, our agribusiness companies, our consumer packaged good companies, creating a tremendous opportunity to bring that young talent of the innovations that can try to solve some of these problems we have. And finally, I always point out with ag research is unique. All of a seed, of course, and one of the things that I think hard for people to grasp is everything we do in ag and food R&D accrues to everyone. Right? It's not, we often hear it accrues to agribusinesses or accrues to food companies. It accrues to everybody because we all eat. So farmers, processors, manufacturers gain from new markets, new development, new opportunities for profitability. Consumers, of course, get new flavorful foods, perhaps a longer sustainable shelf life, for example, some of these products. And future generations gain from cleaner water, improved habitat, impacts on climate change, and abundance of natural resource that we'd hand down to next generations. Dr. Pardee's slides, I couldn't have put those up there better, of that erosion of what's happening with the forest, for example. Can we succeed in doing this? And this is one solution. It's going to take a portfolio. It takes a broad set of research. It's one element of that component that's innovative that I think we're starting to see more buy-in as we see some of the successes that have happened in this program. So thank you for your support. Sorry for my quick comments. We are here, as I say, in CFANS. We're trying to inspire minds, nourish people, and nurture the environment. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Boer. Thank you. Appreciate it. I think we'll move on to your next testifier, and you can get on the road.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So we have Kayla Altendorp. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and the committee.
Just one moment, Representative Miller.
I didn't realize he was leaving. I have a really quick question for Dean Boer, if he'd be willing to answer. Can I make you drive a couple miles an hour faster, Dean? I just have a quick question for the dean. Is that okay, Madam Chair?
It is quick.
Dean Boer, I'm very supportive of Forever Green. You'll hear about that more with a couple questions I have for you later. But this $10 million, right? That's what we're at. So for $10 million, where does this fit in the priority of CFAN's ask to the legislature this year on funding? Is this a top priority? Is this somewhere in the middle? Is it, because $10 million is a lot of money going to CFANs, mm-hmm. and I just want to know where this fits in your grand, like what other things are you going to be asking for?
Dr. Boer.
Yeah, Chair Poppe, Representative Miller, that's a great question, and I'm probably going to give you what seems like a waffling answer. I'm an economist after
all. I trust you.
Okay. So we look at this, as I said, as a portfolio. It is one of the more innovative programs we have. I consider this a platform within CFANS. So when I was here visiting about AGREED, I mentioned platforms that we have, and one of those platforms is novel crop innovation for ecosystem service values. This fits squarely in that platform, so it's one of our priority areas clearly. Other priorities, for example, are agroinformatics, this issue of how do we use precision agriculture for farmers to make better decisions, for example. We're as part of Forever Green, actually, if you read through the brochure, there's a request in there. It's called GEMS. It's genetics by environment, by management, by socioeconomic impact. You know, how do we analyze those values? And we have other priorities. This year, this is the only request that we have that's a focus request with CFANS specifically. So it's a priority, but we, of course, have several priorities. I know this committee is also hearing a bill that was introduced, I believe, by Representative Hamilton and Representative Poppy related to a GREET funding. Of course, that's supported well. But this year, as far as I know, we don't have any other requests coming before the legislature. But I do see this, you know, we're really working to integrate our science with our various aspects. There's an innovation, it's never a straight line, but this is a key priority within the novel crops.
Thank you, Dean Boer. Appreciate it. Yep, okay. Thank you. Now we think you're good to go.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Poppy.
Thank you.
Yep.
All right. Kayla Altendorf, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the committee for the opportunity to speak today. My name is Kayla Altendorf, and I am a graduate student in the Department of Agronomy and Plant Genetics at the University of Minnesota. Today, I have the honor of representing up to or more of 100 incredibly talented, motivated graduate and undergraduate students, postdoctoral scientists, technicians, and faculty, many of whom are here today, who are involved in the Forever Green Initiative. On behalf of this group, there are two points that I'd like to make. The first is that the Forever Green Initiative is unique and attracts high-quality, solution-oriented students and scientists to Minnesota and to the university. Two, we are a multidisciplinary team who is seeking not only to develop new crops, but to utilize a systems approach that ensures these crops, as seen in your handout, are successful in the field and in the marketplace. To illustrate these points, I'll use my experience as a member of the Forever Green Initiative as an example. As an undergraduate environmental studies major, I learned repeatedly about the challenges of agriculture, soil erosion, nutrient runoff, and lack of living cover on the landscape. When I graduated, I knew I wanted to dedicate my career to being a part of the solution. In 2013, I initiated a search, a national search for a graduate program that would prepare me for my career. I spoke to scientists, I visited programs, and it became very clear to me early on that all signs pointed to Minnesota, to the University of Minnesota, and to the Forever Green Initiative. The Forever Green Initiative has provided me unique opportunities that have significantly contributed to my development as a scientist. During my master's project, I developed the foundations for a breeding program for a new crop, pennycress. During my PhD, I've played an important role in the breeding program for the world's first commercialized perennial grain crop. The prospect of these opportunities is what initially drew me to the university, what has kept me here for my PhD, and what attracts and keeps talented scientists and students, many of whom are with me today, in Minnesota. My current project focuses on developing resources for the improvement of intermediate wheatgrass or Kernza. This leads to more improved varieties faster and, more importantly, more perennial crops on the landscape to realize the ecosystem services of this crop. And I'm not alone in this effort. I'm the member of the Kernza team, and I work very closely with a wide variety of people, including plant breeders who develop and identify the best performing germplasm. I work with geneticists who develop critical genomic resources for our breeding program. I work with agronomists who are trying to identify the best way to grow this crop and to maximize yield. I work closely with food scientists who are characterizing the properties of the grain and identifying end uses. I work with farmers who are growing the crop, and I also work with end users, bakers, brewers, and other entrepreneurs who are using this crop in the marketplace. This multidisciplinary team is not unique to Kernza. This is the standard for Forever Green, and the model applies to all the crops you see listed in your handout. We provide not only the much-needed ecosystem services to supplement Minnesota's cropping systems, but also the economically viable end uses and the markets that will support these systems and make it possible for us to achieve our environmental, agriculture, and economic goals. Thank you for your attention, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Altendorf. And we will just go on to the next presenter. So, Gabe Guzmini, welcome to the committee, and just state your name and provide your testimony. Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Gabe Guzmini. I'm the Director of Crop Improvement at PepsiCo. I joined the corporation in 2013 with the remit of creating a new organization to improve crops so that we could help improving entire value chains from farms all the way to the consumers and have an impact on the communities and environments where those value chains operate. I've been in the agricultural research environment for 15 years in my career now, in various different capacities, and I created a few organizations in that space. And I've traveled around the world several times and know most of the research organizations that are out there. In 2013, we started doing our due diligence to determine where in the world we should set up shop, where we could find an organization that had all of the power and potential to make a significant change in those agricultural value chains. And after going around the world another couple of times again, we realized that the only place was the University of Minnesota. Had all of the elements that we were looking for and far beyond those, and Forever Green was one of those programs that was far beyond, was one of those wow moments that we had when we were first exposed to the program. I confidently say that this is the only program in the world that's tackling this problem. This is the only program in the world that has a chance of making a difference in introducing new crops in the value chain that are going not only to feed people, but preserve the environment and build more profitability for the farmers and enable companies like ours to bring those crops in convenient formats to the consumer to improve health and experience from the consumer at the same time as we lessen the impact that we have on the environment in producing those crops. That said, more than happy to take any question when time comes. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Thanks for the testimony. Carmen Fernholt. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee. Carmen Fernholz, I operate a 500-acre certified organic grain farm near Madison, Minnesota. Howard Buffett wrote a book recently called 40 Chances. I've had 45 chances. In fact, a young farmer is going to be taking over the operation a year from now. And I'm grateful for all those 45 chances for sure. But I go back about 10 years when Dr. Don Wise gave me a handful of Kernza seed and he says, go out and plant it on your farm. So I did it. And so over the last 10 years, I've been able to work quite directly with the university in seeing how this Kernza crop has developed. We've looked at the good side and the bad side. But I was able to give them direct feedback on how to develop and improve this product and this grain. And the reason it's really important to me is because as a farmer, as an LSP member, I get a significant amount of pushback on what we as farmers are doing on that land. We talk about water quality. We talk about soil erosion. And so I've been looking, and a lot of farmers have been looking for an opportunity to deal with this and yet be able to generate a viable economic return. And so that's why I really look at the Forever Green Initiative, and I look at the ever-growing potential as the research evolves, the ever-growing potential to be adapted and adopted on our farms here in Minnesota. And when we look at all of the potential, we know that there's still a lot of work. But what I'm beginning to see is that the interest is growing. I've been informed that General Mills is looking for as much Kernza seed as they can possibly find because they are interested in ratcheting up their utilization of this Kernza, and you will probably get a taste of it over there with some of those goodies. But anyway, that's the exciting thing for me as a farmer, because I know that farmers will adapt and take on these crops if they are shown the economic viability of it. But they will also do it because they see the benefits to themselves and to the next generations. And we know that once the university gets it to that level, we as farmers will pick it up very quickly. And so I just can't say enough. And just a quick summary, the first seed that I grew back in 2011 was miniature. The seed that I planted last fall, which was the first release of a developed Kernza seed, was at least double in size. So we know that the research is moving ahead, and once it reaches that point where it's adaptable, farmers will take it on. Thank you very much for your time, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your testimony. Bruce Miller, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Bruce Miller, Minnesota Farmers Union. Thank you, Vice Chair Brand, for sponsoring this legislation. In your packets, you'll find a letter from our President, Gary Werdisch, indicating our long-term support of the policy of Farmers Union for this Forever Green initiative. But I'm here to underline that letter with four very brief points. One is that this creates a unique opportunity for us to partner with a land-grant university. That's a part of why the University of Minnesota exists, and we welcome that opportunity to work as farmers in the development of these new crops. Secondly, this legislation helps create a reliable base of funding for long-term planning to secure faculty and staff and students. I want to point out there's a whole group of University of Minnesota young scientists with us today, and they're here because this legislation affects their lives and their future. Finally, I want to talk about markets. You've heard that General Mills and PepsiCo and other large markets are looking at the development of these 14 crops, but I want to talk about the Kernza team, and I want to particularly talk about the Kernza team in relationship to the Minnesota State Fair. If you've been to the Minnesota State Fair last year or coming this year, come to the Minnesota Farmers Union booth, because our BLT with great Minnesota tomatoes, great Minnesota sweet corn, great all of that great, but it's served on Kernza bread. Mm-hmm. Raised from the farms in Minnesota, so we actually are using this product now in a micro market, baked by the Birchwood Cafe, who also furnished the muffins today. So markets are important. Farmers farm to markets. You all know that. You've heard us say that many times. And it's farmers farm to price. You've heard us say that many times. So we see this legislation as protecting natural resources while increasing profitability, productivity, and efficiency of Minnesota family farmers. So we urge your support of this legislation, and I thank you for the time. And
thank you, Mr.
I'll
Miller.
Stop. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. And I know next up we have Steve Morris.
Hey.
Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. My name is Steve Morris. I'm with the Minnesota Environmental Partnership, and thank you for this hearing today. It was really excellent hearing the people from the university, and particularly the comments from Dr. Pardee talking about how to move forward successfully in the state. We need to use our knowledge, technology, and innovation. And this legislation is about using those skills, building on those characteristics, to not just make progress on issues that are important to us, but actually solve some of these problems. As it relates to environmental impacts of agriculture, particularly water quality, we've been pursuing two paths for more than a generation. One is education, incentives, and regulation to modify how we use our, how we grow our dominant crops on the landscape. And what we found is once in a while success, but overall I'd say we're not really making progress on some of these water quality issues. The other strategy we've used that does work is to take land out of production and put it into conservation set-aside with some sort of permanent cover. It has dramatic impacts. We've talked about it. It gives us water quality. It gives us habitat for pollinators and other wildlife, and it builds carbon in the soil, ever more important. The good news is that there's a third path that does this, because it's impractical to take all as much land as we would need to take out of production in order to address our environmental issues. So the third path is what we're talking about today. How can we use market forces to actually get the benefits of conservation set-aside lands in agricultural production crops? And so it's the melding of those two approaches that we find so exciting about this, because these winter annuals and cover crops will provide us the benefits. It'll keep the land in ag production, and it'll keep profitable options for farmers and our communities going. So we're excited by this work. We're excited by the market-based approach, which over the long run is affordable and will be durable and be with us for a long time. So we ask for your strong support for full funding for the university to now ramp up and actually seize the opportunity we've been creating over the last few years with more modest funding. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Morris. We have a question. Representative Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Two real quick questions, promise. I'm very supportive of the Forever Green. I've been pretty vocal about that. I actually got Southern Miss Sugar Beets involved a little bit. I'm not sure exactly, but I brought Dr. Weiss down there a couple of years ago. And I think as long as there's a profitable, marketable formula to this, we have a great future with it. But I have two quick questions. One's for Mr. Savory, I believe, can answer this. What's the current base for Forever Green? And is this going on to the base on top of that? And then while he's looking, Madam Chair, I have a question for you.
Mm-hmm.
And you can go in whatever order. Thank you, Madam Chair. So kind of some of the bigger highlighted things for the budget this year would be the $10 million for here. I believe we're asking for $10 million increase also. Is that correct? Is that what it is? That's what the request was for Agreed? And then we have the mental health, and then we have other bills. How's the targets looking or coming on? Are we going to be able to do some of these things? I've been in agriculture for 4 years, and the targets usually aren't overly impressive. What can we anticipate, maybe as we move forward? Maybe it's a preliminary question, but as we move forward, I'd like to know that.
I will quickly answer that, Representative Miller. I'm sure the target will never be high enough to cover all of these issues that people are bringing forward. But I will tell you, I actually think some of these things should come out of the higher ed budget. And I introduced a bill that would raise the ag specials because I believe that we are seeking funding for the University of Minnesota, and I appreciate that it's coming through the ag budget, but there may be other ways to reach the same conclusion. So perhaps we'll have a number of pots of money that will be able to deal with that.
I agree with you, Madam Chair. So just curiosity from Mr.
Yes,
Savory.
And so Mr. Savory.
Madam Chair and members, and just kind of some brief looking at a spreadsheet I have. Per the November forecast, so in fiscal year 18, I'm tracking spending of $905,000 in fiscal 18 for the Forever Green program. If memory serves me, that this bill would not add to that existing base, it would essentially start the program over again from an appropriation standpoint. So we'd see new funding from a base of zero for 20 and 21. But I can go back and look at.
No, that's okay. I actually wanted to know what the increase basically was going to look like. So thank you.
Thank you. All right. We have another question, Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is just more of a couple comments rather than questions. But I want to thank Representative Brand for bringing this forward, and thank the scientists that have been working in the Forever Green initiative and connect a couple dots. So yesterday I was in the Environment Committee and I was presenting legislation related to wellhead protection areas and a pilot program that we're moving on, wanting to invite farmers into planting cover crops in these wellhead protection areas to improve water quality in rural areas. And the Kernza grain is a key piece of that in providing both ecological benefits and potential economic benefits, too. So it's a key part of that. And so Forever Green is making this possible in other places in our state government and for rural communities. And also, we have a conversation about wise use of taxpayer dollars regularly here and in other committees. It's usually framed around what we spend and how much, and that's extremely important. But I would also say that it needs to be about where we spend. And are the dollars that we're spending creating the future that we need? And I think Forever Green is really at the heart of creating the future that we need, and we need to be thinking about that question as we're making these decisions about our budget going forward.
Representative Cleburne.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And I would just like to echo Representative Lippert's comments as well. When we first looked at soybeans years ago, we had pushback about whether or not that was the proper use of budgets. And when we developed Honeycrisp apples, people wanted to know about that. When we think about new, innovative cropping systems, I cannot imagine a more appropriate place than the Agricultural and Food Committee. this project takes the green revolution into this century. It's a progression of Minnesota's rich heritage of agriculture and food. And I would encourage this committee with my whole heart to please consider this as a real agricultural cropping system. It's not just climate. It's not just clean water. It is an agricultural cropping system. Right now, under the snow, there could be a crop in place for farmers to benefit economically into the future. It is a cropping system. It's one of the core platforms. I encourage the members of this committee to support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Brand, do you have some brief closing comments?
Yeah, brief closing comments. I think Representative Lippert hit it on the head. You know, the Working Lands Bill is another great tool when we talk about ways that we can protect water, which is critical to our needs in Minnesota. And we also have to consider what we do with our water. Water is a precious resource. It's the only place in the universe where it exists is on our planet. Yet we take it for granted every day. We flush it down our toilets and we waste it when we actually should be conserving it. We should be looking at ways to protect it. And so I think it's really important that we do talk about this in this committee. And I think Representative Cleburne's exactly right. A food and policy, a finance and committee should take this on, I think. And this provides a new system for Minnesota. This provides a new revolution for Minnesota. And so I thank you for your words as well. And, you know, I think at the end of the day, we have to strive to do better, not for us, but for our future. We've got a lot of folks in blue jackets walking around today that for very great reasons, not so distant future, might be planting these grains, these products from public research and public funded research in our Minnesota landscapes. And so I'm excited for that, too. We're the only people in the entire world that are doing this right now, and I think that that shouldn't be taken for granted either.
Representative Brand, do you renew your motion?
Yes, I renew my motion to lay over the House File 962 for possible inclusion in the Agriculture Omnibus Bill.
Thank you. With that, House File 962 is laid over, and we have no other testimony or nothing before the committee again. So with that, we are adjourned. Thank you.